Hey, it's Weezo. You're listening to Talk Today's Top and Trendy Technology Topics every Tuesday and Thursday with Adam Lepp, the computer guy, between 2:13 p.m. and 3 right here on The Talking Place, WWGH 107.1.
When you need to talk technology, no one gets you more gigs in your hard drive than Adam. It's time for Adam the Computer Guy with Adam Lepp.
A very good Tuesday afternoon to you. Nice summery weather outside, but that's kind of what you expect in early July. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, thanking you for tuning in. We got some great news and views and insights on the show today. We will talk first about a couple who has cloned their cat. Did cost $25,000, but the cloning was successful and they're very happy with the result. But some major stories about data privacy. Is ICE doing things that they shouldn't do with driver's license and motor vehicle department records? What are companies doing when they give you a free sample or free membership, free subscription? Are they taking your information and doing things that are naughty? Well, we already know they probably are, but I'm going to talk more about that in detail. Also, some updates on some very cool but potentially complicated things that companies are doing with drones. Food delivery, medical supply delivery, a test program in San Diego that's going to get underway a little later in the summer. Again, if you ever want to email me, tell me what you think about the show. A suggested topic, comments, questions, complaints, always welcome. Send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Adam@WWGH1071.com. A couple in Charlotte, North Carolina, has successfully cloned their 19-year-old cat named Cinnabon after it recently passed away. Ashley and Brian Bullerdick found a Texas-based company known for cloning dogs, cats, and horses. They bought a kit for $25,000, took a skin and saliva sample, and voila, Cinnabon 2 was born. The couple says the now 5-month-old cat behaves and looks just like its predecessor. As for a possible Cinnabon 3, the Bullerdicks said they aren't counting it out, but hope this kitty lives a long, full life, just like the original Cinnabon. So pretty cool, $25,000, but you get to clone your cat. Hopefully 19 years of excellent cathood, if that's a word, from Cinnabon number 2, and just interesting what technology can do. Cloning a cat. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, with news and views from the world of technology and innovative things that occur in the great world around us. On The Talking Place, WWGH Radio. Government surveillance and spying, we talk about that and you read about that in the news, well, probably several times a day. It's a hot topic, especially if it comes to immigration enforcement, and that's what this story is about. This is definitely a hot and very interesting topic. State motor vehicle departments have become a rich source of facial recognition data for the FBI and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, agents. Researchers at Georgetown Laws Center on Privacy and Technology use public records requests to gather a cache of documents that show the agencies have turned State Department of Motor Vehicle databases into the foundation of a vast surveillance infrastructure. And that was reported earlier by the Washington Post. The records show that federal law enforcement has fostered a very friendly relationship with state DMV officials, again, according to the Washington Post, in a story reported in early July. For example, in Utah, FBI and ICE agents performed more than 1,000 facial recognition searches between 2015 and 2017. Jeremy D. Scott is the senior counsel and director of the Domestic Surveillance Project. That sounds like a fun job. At the Electronic Privacy Information Center, an advocacy organization in Washington, D.C. He said the use of Department of Motor Vehicle, or DMV, photos for facial recognition is essentially treating everyone as a suspect. The practice should be stopped for the time being, and the use of facial recognition needs to be weighed by Congress and the public, because it's an extremely privacy-invasive technology that poses serious risk to civil liberties. The technology has attracted congressional attention in recent months. The House Committee on Oversight and Reform held meetings in May and June of this year on the impact of facial recognition technology on civil rights and liberties. The House Committee on Homeland Security will be holding hearings to learn how the Transportation Safe Security Administration, as well as Customs and Border Protection and the Secret Service, use this very powerful facial recognition technology. Jake LaPerouque, the senior counsel for the Constitution Project at the On Government Oversight, they're a government watchdog group in Washington, D.C., said, "Rules need to be set on the general use of facial recognition. Right now, it's an incredibly invasive technology that's being applied without limits. It's the Wild West." A quarter of all police departments have the capacity to use facial recognition technology, and the FBI runs an average of 4,000 searches a month. He said Congress should set a floor for how and when this technology should be used, just as we have limits for wiretaps and other kinds of surveillance activities. States and counties should be allowed to adopt stricter standards if they think they are necessary. Law enforcement is always going to be looking for a way to push to the edge of any acceptable behavior. We've seen cases where they've run police sketches through a facial recognition database, and that's crazy. We've also seen them run pictures of celebrities through a database after being told a suspect looked like a certain celebrity. And that comes from Jake LaPerouque, senior counsel for the Constitution Project at the On Government Oversight, a government watchdog group in Washington, D.C. Some pretty interesting and powerful perspectives from that gentleman. Law professor Joel R. Reidenberg, he weighed in. He is from Fordham University, the School of Law in New York City. He said ICE's bulk searches of Department of Motor Vehicle databases assume that everyone in the database is guilty in order to find a particular individual. That's a significant civil liberties infringement for drivers across the country. ICE doesn't need warrants to do that kind of search. I think we should impose, by statute, a warrant requirement. Now, driver license information is protected by a federal statute. And that was passed 25 years ago, the Driver's Privacy Protection Act of 1994. But law enforcement agencies are exempt from the restrictions of that law. The law is 25 years old now, according to Professor Joel Reidenberg from Fordham University. It was enacted before the days of digital photography. So this kind of data mining wasn't even on the horizon. The old law doesn't satisfy our current concerns. Jacinta Gonzalez, a senior campaign organizer for Mejente, a Latino and Chicano advocacy group in Phoenix, said, "Technology and access to data is moving faster than the protection of people's rights, which is leading to abuse and privacy violations. This has an impact on everyone. They may experiment on migrants and vulnerable communities first, but left unchecked, this will become the status quo. If used properly, facial recognition is obviously a tool that can greatly enhance the capabilities of all kinds of law enforcement and protect public safety, which is, of course, the object of law enforcement. But if it's used carelessly and improperly, it may have a negative impact on privacy and civil liberties." And that comes from Kimberly J. Del Greco of the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Services Division in testimony submitted to the House Oversight Committee. FBI policy strictly governs the circumstances in which facial recognition tools may be utilized. For example, policies include facial recognition being used in conjunction with human review and investigation. Any leads produced by facial recognition are followed up by investigators to corroborate it before further action is taken. Every face query, including results received from FBI partners, is reviewed and evaluated by trained examiners at the FBI to ensure the results are consistent with FBI standards. Facial recognition capabilities are regularly tested, evaluated, and improved. In addition to system testing, the FBI has partnered with other organizations to ensure algorithm performance is evaluated. Once our adversaries and the threats we face are relentless, and according to Kimberly Del Greco of the FBI's Criminal Justice Information Services Division in a testimony she submitted to the House Oversight Committee, she said the FBI must continue to identify and use new capabilities such as automated face recognition technology to meet the high expectations for the FBI to preserve our nation's freedoms, as well as ensure our liberties are protected and preserve our security. Privacy. Not a single technology like facial recognition is the big issue facing society today. And that comes from George Brostoff, CEO of Sensible Vision, a face authentication company in Cape Coral, Florida. He said, you don't need a driver's license database to find a photo of most people. All you need to do is a Google search. It'll bring up photos from Facebook and many other places, and I can attest to that being very true. What we need to regulate is our privacy, whether it be facial recognition or fingerprints or phone data or our browser histories. That's where the laws need to be updated to meet what a majority of the people in the country feel is appropriate. I have reasonable confidence that technology can improve the job law enforcement can do. But just like any tool that people use, there has to be an understanding of the limits of that tool, and our laws have to reflect when and how it's used. So ICE and Departments of Motor Vehicles, facial recognition, databases, it's a tangled web that we weave. Let me know what you think. Do they have a right to get this data, use it for what could be ulterior purposes, could be thought of as discriminatory purposes? An interesting topic of discussion. Again, I'd love to hear from you. Leave a comment on our Facebook page or send me an email, adam@wwgh1071.com. So what's going on over at Uber, the ride-sharing and food delivery company? Uber Elevate, that is a division of Uber, recently announced they will start a fast food delivery by drone test service this summer in San Diego. Food delivery by drone. That sounds fun. Delivery destinations will not be houses or apartment buildings, but instead will be designated safe landing zones. Those landing zones could include the roof of a parked Uber vehicle in one scenario. An Uber courier could receive the package and hand deliver it to the consumer. McDonald's is one of Uber's partners, and it has been delivering special packaging to keep food hot and intact during the aerial portion of a delivery. When Uber Elevate's drone delivery actually would take a flight has been up in the air for some time. The FAA has only granted its approval recently. They've designated San Diego as one of the 10 U.S. locations for the testing of commercial drone service. Now, as you probably have seen in the news, San Diego has become a hotbed of drone research, partially due to the military presence there, but also thanks to weather that is reliably sunny and calm. You know, it's pretty much summer every day in San Diego. I kind of like the four-season climate in Marion, but to each his or her own, and sometimes it's nice to have summer every day. It just gets a little bit boring. But the around-the-clock summer weather in San Diego is very good for drones, for obvious reasons. Snow and wind with drones doesn't always work too well, but when it's spring or summer every day, it probably helps. But even when Uber Elevate is able to get its drone program off the ground, it likely will not maintain its air supremacy for long. Walmart, getting into the picture, they've reportedly filed more drone patent applications than Amazon for the second year in a row. They've beat Amazon. How about that? Wing Aviation, which is owned by Alphabet, the parent company of Google, in April, announced that it has also received certification from the FAA to begin delivering small packages in two rural Virginia communities near Blacksburg. Given that drones will be subject to many restrictions, for example, no flying over densely populated areas, it's not clear what advantages they offer over other delivery methods. But delivery could be just one part of the role that drones play in the near future. Ted Stenck, facility director and professor of logistics at the University of Tennessee Global Supply Chain Initiative, said, "Drones are for real in key areas of the supply chain. Checking inventory levels in huge distribution centers, flying manufacturing lines to determine when new parts are needed on the line, inspecting far-flung facilities and pipelines. It's coming," he said. "Otherwise, Amazon, Walmart, Uber, Google, etc. would not be pushing it so hard." Yeah, all the big players, and that obviously means something. Still, he doesn't see it happening anytime soon. "There are too many legislative and regulatory issues to work through before it can scale to any kind of volume. For the short term," Ted Stenck, again, a professor of logistics at the University of Tennessee, said he sees this drone delivery of food more of a novelty in terms of last-mile delivery of products. Even as drones are tested in Blacksburg, Virginia, and San Diego, another potential use in the near term is the delivery of medical items in areas that are difficult to reach by car or by walking. That certainly could save a few lives and keep costs down. "There may be some application for extremely high-value products or highly perishable ones or having to go to a very difficult location to reach. U.S. startup Zipline already is utilizing drones to make blood deliveries to remote hospitals and aid stations in the country of Rwanda. Using drone technology for humanitarian and commercial purposes, as opposed to just recreational ones, is inevitable. There is just too much potential to ignore." That comes from Professor James Bailey from the George Washington University School of Business. "To human welfare, imagining delivering a vasodilator to someone suffering an angina episode in half the time it would take an ambulance to arrive. The same could hold true for the delivery of food and supplies to an isolated village after a tsunami or other disaster. Such applications will enjoy widespread support." Of course, there are a number of issues and challenges that need to be overcome before drones will be making routine deliveries of Big Macs and Amazon boxes. First, how does the drone access an order effectively and efficiently? Can it do it automated, or does someone have to load it at cost? Then, of course, liability. What if the drone crashes? Or what if someone shoots it down to steal the order, which people have jokingly called skeet shooting for prizes? For those reasons and others, the flight path to commercial application will be more turbulent. Anything can be hacked these days, including the signals flowing to drones, and the drones could be downed for the heck of it, hijacked for theft or cargo tainted. Mischievous boys could launch their own squad for aerial assaults or just throw rocks. Such roguery could cause more chaos than malware. Public patience for business pursuits will be short and the legal ramifications tall. There are other issues and challenges that need to be overcome before drones will be making routine deliveries. For example, Uber Elevate is opting to have designated landing zones, such as on the cars of vehicles marked with a QR code. That's that, you know, square with the solid rectangles and shapes in it. But that might not be practical for all deliveries. Zipline literally parachutes the blood products onto hospital roofs in Rwanda. But that will not work for most consumer goods. Then there is the issue of returns or even stolen packages on the ground. Certainly, information technology like video camera feeds can address many of these issues, but can it be done at a low cost? And can it be scaled for anything other than to make a cool impression and YouTube video? There are a lot of supply chain-related applications for drones that do not require last-mile delivery of products. Possible uses for these applications ensure compliance of Uber drivers in the passenger business, location and ID of shipments for Uber Freight, and any kind of role that requires visibility into parts of the supply chain that have typically been difficult to gain access to. Something else, again, we're talking about drones delivering possibly a Big Mac or other fast food item, but also delivering medical supplies quicker than an ambulance or a human messenger on foot could do it. And that can save lives and save money. Another consideration is where exactly drone delivery could take flight. Some cutting-edge technologies, for example, autonomous vehicles, self-driving cars, we talk about that a lot, seem poised for a rollout in urban markets. But as there are restrictions for flying over densely populated areas like New York City and San Francisco, those don't seem like obvious areas for a drone. Therefore, drone delivery and self-driving cars aren't likely to be complementary, and yet both technologies are being developed by the same companies. Then, of course, there's the issue of developing competition to provide quick and easy food delivery. Well, you could be delivering a phone, but we're talking about food and medical supplies. Uber's business model seems off. They already have countless drivers eager to swing by a McDonald's to pick you up some burgers. Grubhub and others do too, and delivery time in the food industry is in preparation as much as anything else. Thus, their drones can return to the same origination for another pickup, but there are thousands of restaurants in any urban area, and the margins on food are already very thin, while the cost of a drone fleet will raise prices above consumers' sensitive purchase point. Is it scalable? Is it affordable? Can regulatory and legal issues be resolved? To make a delivery to a rural location is obviously expensive. There is no density of demand, and distances can be long. Thus, sending a drone makes sense. In addition, since the drone will not be transiting through populated areas for the most part, the legal and regulatory issues, as well as the challenges of safe operation, should be far less than in an urban area. All of these points could be moot, as the final decision on where drones can make delivery will reside with the FAA. Although some testing sites have been approved, the FAA will not be granting business licenses anytime in the near future. The United States has among the safest national airspaces on the planet. They're not going to compromise that for 1 hour delivery of a Big Mac. So yeah, drones delivering items, but logistical and legal and practical barriers. But I'm sure the smart people will figure it out, and we'll keep you updated on this and other important and interesting tech topics here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program. WWGH, 107.1 FM in Marion, and online anywhere in the world. WWGH1071.com. Data privacy, it's a hot topic on this show and pretty much every time we get together here on The Talking Place. In 2019, you can pretty much find anything about anybody or any company if you have the right connections or have the right privileges. Well, the ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, recently released documents showing the NSA, they're always in the news, aren't they, improperly collected Americans' call and text logs in November 2017 and February and October of 2018. Well, even your texting isn't safe from the NSA. You know, I joke about how the NSA is constantly watching us, phone calls, texts, Facebook, whatever, and this story may indicate that I'm not exaggerating. So the unauthorized collections occurred just 4 months after the NSA announced they were deleting more than 620 million call detail records acquired since 2015 under Title V of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. What happened was that the NSA relied on the improperly collected information from the February 2018 violation to seek approval from the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to spy on individuals, according to the ACLU. The NSA later informed the court of the error, according to the ACLU, but there's no indication whether anyone was spied on unlawfully as a result, or whether the agency notified people improperly, spied upon, as required. Now, last October, the NSA again discovered it had obtained private information about Americans' phone calls in violation of Section 215 of the Patriot Act. The agency stopped receiving data from the carrier involved, but resumed accepting data after the carrier indicated it had resolved the problem, according to the ACLU. The ACLU obtained the redacted documents by filing a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in December. The 2015 USA Freedom Act, adopted in 2015 after the well-publicized Edward Snowden incident, where he disclosed the NSA's surveillance activities, restricts the government's phone record program. And that comes from Andrew Crocker, senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, or the EFF. He said, "We've learned that the NSA has been entirely unsuccessful in working within these limits, leading to the continued collection of hundreds of millions of phone records, including many it was not entitled to under the law." The NSA blamed the renewed spying on carriers' mistakes. See, it's never their fault, is it? Stating that technical irregularities led it to receive call detail records it was not authorized to obtain. Sandra Fulton is the government relations director at Free Press, and she said, "We don't know what caused the NSA's egregious noncompliance. Broadly, it seems to be the result of at least one carrier overproducing the amount of user data it is meant to give the agency, but within the system designed by the NSA, so the fault is on both sides." Yasha Haidari is from the Haidari Power Law Group. And he said, "While it is entirely possible there could be a sinister reason behind it, we have seen time and time again the nature of bureaucratic inefficiencies when dealing with large agencies. Otherwise, I would expect a more evasive response. And indeed, I would not believe we would even be hearing about this issue." Michael Jude, program manager at Straightcast Frost and Sullivan, we quote him often, said, "Presented with a request for a particular population of numbers and associated dial information, you're going to capture a lot of extra stuff. Metadata is leaky. Even criminals and enemy agents make calls to local pizza places, and you have all that information captured in the metadata. I don't think technology is up to protecting people's privacy and call patterns." The bigger question, he noted, is whether the NSA is using the data the way it should. That's the million-dollar question. What are they doing with the data? Do they have ulterior motives? Are they violating our privacy as Americans? The NSA for years has fought calls for greater transparency on the grounds of national security. It has not yet responded to a demand from six Democratic Party Senate Intelligence Committee members to release a public update on its mass phone data collection program. Earlier this year, a court dismissed the Electronic Frontier Foundation's lawsuit challenging the NSA's surveillance of Americans. That was Jewell versus NSA. On national security grounds, the Electronic Frontier Foundation filed an appeal with the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Earlier this year, the NSA also recommended dropping the phone surveillance program, according to reports, because its logistical and legal issues outweighed any intelligence benefits. It apparently has quietly killed the program since then. And in June, the ACLU wrote the House Judiciary Committee urging it to end the NSA's Section 15 call detail record authority and to investigate and make public additional information about the agency's recent compliance violations. The NSA may have replicated its collection of surveillance data under a different authority. ACLU Senior Legislative Counsel Nema Singh Giuliani speculated, and she urged Congress to prevent resurrection of the program. Here's what she also suggested. Let Section 215 of the Patriot Act expire at the end of the year as scheduled. Pass additional reforms to halt large-scale surveillance being conducted under other Patriot Act authorities. Strengthen existing First Amendment protections. Limit how federal agencies can access and use information that's collected, and ensure they provide notice to individuals when information is used in criminal proceedings. Close the backdoor search loophole in Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act. So, several reforms being proposed for the NSA. They are snooping on people and companies beyond what they should be doing or beyond what would actually be useful, especially to law-abiding American citizens. Meanwhile, Senators Ron Wyden, Democrat from Oregon, Rand Paul, Kentucky Republican, Justin Amash, Michigan Republican, and Zoe Lofgren, Democrat from California, jointly introduced the Ending Mass Collection of Americans Records Act in the House and Senate. However, it has a mere 4% chance of being enacted, a 1 in 25 chance it'll actually become law, according to Scopus Labs. Abdullah Hassan is a spokesperson with the ACLU. He said this bipartisan effort to end the NSA's call detail record authority is a welcome sign and something that should be a no-brainer for Congress. We agree with the senators that broader legislative reforms to the NSA's surveillance authorities are needed, including limiting large-scale collection of data, preventing discrimination and First Amendment violations, and enhancing transparency. So some much-needed reforms may be coming to the NSA. A lot of controversy. Are they doing things they shouldn't? Well, I think that story pretty much sums it up. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy with news and views from technology and technology intermingling with politics and other things that we encounter in the world every single day. The Talking Place, WWGH 107.1 FM in Marion and online anywhere in the world, WWGH1071.com. Data privacy, always a big topic. Here's another story along those lines. A Democrat and a Republican. Well, it's always good to see different parties working together because of all the divisiveness we currently have in this country. So at least the story starts out on what seems like it could be a positive note. Democrat-Republican, back in June, filed a U.S. Senate bill to require companies to report to financial regulators and to the public, you and me, what consumer data they collect and how they leverage it for profit. Those were Senators Josh Hawley, a Republican from Missouri, and Mark Warner, that's a hard name to say. Mark R. Warner from Virginia, he's a Democrat. Senator Hawley said, when a big tech company says its product is free, consumers are the ones being sold. Yes, you may get a free trial or some sample, but what kind of information are they getting? And that information could very well be worth a lot more than the product or information that you think you're getting for free. So they introduced the Designing Accounting Safeguards to help broaden oversight and regulations on data. I just love these acronyms. It comes out to spell dashboard. Designing Accounting Safeguards to help broaden oversight and regulations on data. The Dashboard Act. Pretty cool. Senator Hawley, again, a Republican from Missouri, said, these so-called free products track everything we do so tech companies can sell our information to the highest bidder and use it to target us with creepy ads. Even worse, tech companies do their best to hide how much consumer data is worth and to whom it is sold. This bipartisan legislation gives consumers control of their data and will show them how much these so-called free services actually cost. Consumers are paying for free products with their data instead of with their wallets. The overall lack of transparency and disclosure in this market have made it impossible for users to know what they're giving up, who else their data is being shared with, or what it's worth to the platform. Our bipartisan bill Just love hearing that. Democrats, Republicans working together. They're on the same team. They're all Americans. They can put other differences aside. So anyway, Senator Warner said, our bipartisan bill will allow consumers to understand the true value of the data they are providing to the platforms, which will encourage competition and allow antitrust enforcers to identify potentially anti-competitive practices. So, what is behind this Dashboard Act? Again, it relates to companies getting our information when they give you a so-called free or reduced price item or service. Well, several things, and this looks like a pretty good idea to me. First, it requires commercial data operators defined as services with more than 100 million monthly active users to disclose the types of data they collect, as well as regularly provide their users with an assessment of the value of that data. It will require commercial data operators to file an annual report on the aggregate value of user data that they've collected, as well as contracts with third parties involving data collection. Require commercial data operators to allow users to delete all or individual fields of data collected and disclose to users all the ways in which their data is being used, including any uses not directly related to the online service for which the data was originally collected. And it will empower the U.S. Security and Exchange Commission, the SEC, to develop methodologies for calculating data value while encouraging the agency to facilitate flexibility to enable businesses to adopt methodologies that reflect different uses as well as sectors and business models. Good stuff. Again, the Dashboard Act, recently introduced by a Democrat and Republican senator to make sure that companies don't get information from you that they have no business getting their hands on. Senator Warner also pledged to introduce a bill this summer to require technology companies to make data collected from users portable so it can be moved easily from one platform to another. If you have data portability, it could open things up quite a bit. That comes from French Caldwell, the chief financial officer of the Analyst Syndicate, an IT research and analysis group in Washington. He said it would allow you to easily move your data from a player like Facebook to a new competitor. How easy or frictionless the companies will make it to move data among platforms will be a thorny issue should the bill become law. He said, I doubt it's going to be made real easy to do. What's more, portability can only have an impact on the competitive landscape if there are competitors to take the data to. Kendra Albert, clinical instructor at the Cyber Law Clinic at Harvard University's Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society in Cambridge, Massachusetts, said, many of the large tech companies effectively purchase their competitors. She said data portability is all well and good and could foster competition, but it doesn't work if there are no effective competitors in the market because they keep getting purchased by the larger companies. She said more information about how companies gather data would provide greater benefit to consumers than how much money they make off of it. Knowing what your data is worth doesn't get you much when there's effectively no competition in particular services. Daniel Castro is the director of the Center for Data Innovation of the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, a research and public policy organization in Washington, D.C. It's quite a title. So Daniel Castro said, the idea that consumers are getting a rotten deal when they give up their data for free services is wrong. While data may have value, paying for a service with data is not the same as paying with money. And he's right. You get a free sample, a free service, a subscription, but they find out your life story. Is it worth it? I'd rather pay $19 a month, for goodness sakes. And that's what he's saying. Unlike money, consumers do not have less data after sharing personal information. And they can share that same data with other services as well. On the contrary, for most commercial services, consumers always come out ahead by sharing data in exchange for a free service. The legislation would make companies go through an expensive process of trying to assign a value to each user an activity that almost certainly would irritate consumers, even if required by the government. He said, in no other sector does the government require businesses to reveal which customers are most valuable to them. Further, if Congress wants to require this disclosure, it should extend it to businesses of all sizes as well as political campaigns. Provisions in the proposed law that direct the SEC to develop a methodology for calculating data value, its sources for data collection, and how the company safeguards the data are all reasonable and should be the basis for any bill that moves forward. As things stand now, the technology companies know the value of the data they are collecting, and consumers don't know that value. And that comes from Rob Enderle. We quote him quite often. He's in Bend, Oregon. He's with the Enderle Group, an IT advisory service. He said, typically, when one side knows the value of something and the other side doesn't, then the side that doesn't know the value of that thing gets cheated. The problem with this bill is the companies will be doing the valuations, and there's nothing to stop the company from undervaluing the asset. The bill needs a stronger process for setting the value of information so it does not excessively advantage the vendor. However, the chances of the bill becoming law are low, according to Rob Enderle. Congress doesn't know enough about these issues, and when people don't know enough about something, they're likely to hold on to the status quo. But the bill could be arriving at a good time. Concerns about privacy and the power of big tech are higher than ever right now. And yes, privacy is always something that we need to talk about. We talk about tech topics every Tuesday and Thursday here on the Adam the Computer Guy radio program. Almost time to end another adventure into the world of technology and related and ancillary topics. But before we say goodbye on this nice summery Tuesday afternoon, want to remind you to keep your radio or virtual listening device right where it is. Don't touch that dial, or as Scott says, just break off the tuning knob because you really don't need it. Why listen to any other station? Coming up later today, the very lovely Linda Sims graces our airwaves with her Tuesday program, and also later today, it is the Pastor's Spot with Reverend Steve Whitaker. That's brought to you on this station every Tuesday afternoon. Good stuff for you, 24/7 at WWGH Radio. Tomorrow morning, Charlie Evers, who's been on the radio for 174 years at least, will be on with the Charlie Evers program between about 12:10 a.m. and noon. Taking your calls, contests, interesting guests from around the community, interesting, important, and newsworthy trivia about things going on in the great mid and central Ohio area where we live and we work. That's every Wednesday and Thursday between about 12 or 13 minutes after 10 in the a.m. and noon. Radio well worth listening to also. On Friday evening, between about 13 minutes after 8 and 10 in the p.m., it is the Weasel program at its new time. Join Chad, also known as Weasel Boy or the Weeze or Weasel, as he takes your phone calls, plays silly pranks, takes some silly tests, taste tests, trivia, who knows what else. And his lovely wife, Heather Marie, joins him as they discuss life, parenthood, and who knows what else. I assure you, that is more radio that your ears and brain cells will be very thankful for. Every Friday between about 13 after 8 in the p.m. and 10 p.m. If you ever miss a radio program on this station, that's okay. We'll forgive you this one time. Go to our website, WWGH1071.com. Go to the show archives, and you can listen on demand to me, to Charlie, to Scott, to Weasel, to Pastor Whitaker, and many other people. Well worth visiting that website frequently. Last but not least, we have a private email server. Hillary, eat your heart out. We have a private email server which is administered and curated. That's what I wanted to say, by yours truly. I'd love to get your emails. Just to say hi, that's fine too. Questions, comments, complaints, always welcome. Adam@WWGH1071.com. You can also email Scott. He also loves getting your emails. Scott at WWGH1071.com. Thank you again for listening. Talk to you again on Thursday. AdamTheComputerGuy.com.